So I say, first thing I want to do is name the state of being free of suffering. And because we're talking about compassion tonight, last night we talked about loving kindness. Right, about compassion, which is where we want to get. Then, having named the state of where you want to get, then you have to look at what it is that is causing the obstruction to that. So in order to look at compassion, you have to look at suffering. Now that's a little different, isn't it? These classes, this time that you are so kind as to invite me here, are about the four boundless states of consciousness, which are loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. They're boundless because they're not caught in an object that defines you. So there isn't a sense of something to get or something to get away from. The mind is therefore free to move as far as it wishes. Does that make sense to you? Mm-hmm. So, most of the time, if you look at your thoughts are actually bounded, aren't they? You have something you're going to do, or somebody you have to think about, why did they do that, or why shouldn't you do this, or there's always a subject and an object there. And it's very difficult to conceive of a boundless thought, wouldn't you say? What would a boundless thought feel like? I was very fortunate as a child. I grew up in Alberta. Alberta is called Big Sky Country. As a child, I used to go away from my family house and lie in the prairie. The grass always was very high. It's gotten much shorter. I've noticed that with the hills, too. The hills that I rode my bicycle up. And as a child, somebody's come along and plowed them down or something. They're so much smaller. It's incredible. I don't know what happened to them. There's no challenge for youth anymore. Anyway, not to get too sidetracked. As a child, I can remember so many days just lying in the grass and watching the grass above you, and then past the heads of the grass, this space with these clouds moving through. But they were always moving, and if you watched them, they would shift and change. So they weren't an object that you could pin on. Now that's a boundless thing, isn't it? Child lying on your back. There's nothing to stop your mind. Probably one or two of you have done that as well. I mean, farm girls definitely have, I would say. Probably. Can you remember doing that?
I did it a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, there is. There's parts of you that are still in childhood. Okay. We'll count that. A nice thing to do, isn't it?
It's kind of brought me down.
Did it? Feeling like you were grounded, you mean? Mm-hmm. So, I'm saying this because from a Buddhist perspective, if one is skilled in practicing compassion, which you'd start by paying attention to states of suffering, what it ends as is awareness of space. How does this happen? First of all, to begin the practice of compassion, you move from the awareness of may I live happily, which we talked about yesterday, that that's the main mantra for practicing of Lam Prayers. May I live happily. And then after you say that for a long time, you see other people and you think, as I am, may also that be happily. And then pretty soon you get, so you spread it. There's a very specific order for how you do it. You spread it out to all places, all times, all beings. And you start by saying, may I live happily. So after you, there's those bells and whistles. So after you've done that work with loving kindness and you have established a sense within yourself of some kind of ease, some kind of contentment, some kind of happiness. Maybe not that you have achieved the perfection that you're going to be when you die. Or whatever other criteria, but just for a moment there is this sense of relaxing into what is. Then at that point you can move to meditation on compassion. Because if you try to regard the state of suffering from a suffering state, you're only going to get into more suffering. If you try to get out of a pit, if you try to help someone else out of a pit when you're still in a pit, neither one of you are going to get out of the pit.
Mm.
If you try to consider states of suffering, if you do not have a basic wholesome sense of your own being, you're just going to fall into a pit of suffering. So one of the criteria for doing practice of compassion is to have a felt sense of yourself as being happy, worthy, comfortable, some type of confidence, some type of confidence. And once you've established that, then you can proceed with the practice of compassion. But if you try to practice compassion without that sense, you're going to get tired, you're going to get angry, you're going to get caught. You can feel that, can't you? You're going to resent other people having their troubles. How dare you suffer in my face? I just don't have time for this. You know that feeling? So first is to establish that sense of your own confidence, your own being. So we spoke about that a little bit last night. So tonight we're going to assume that you have that sense of confidence. And then look at, all right, then what do you do next? Then the next thing you do is you consider someone for whom you can feel a power to help. Like, for example, maybe you'd budget out how much money you can afford to spend foolishly, so without any feeling of lack on your part, that week. Now you put that money in different pockets of clothes you plan to wear. Then when you're wearing those clothes on that day, you reach in your pocket somehow, you find that money, so that you know that one of the things you have to do within the next 2 hours of finding it is go and find somebody to give it to.
Mm.
So when you go and you see somebody to give it to, you actually look at them, and you feel what their need is. And you feel a sense of wishing that they didn't suffer hunger or cold. And then you give them the money. And it's your joy to give. It is your power to help them out of suffering. That's a very nice way to start the practice, by moving your body. And you're not causing this, you're not making it something that happens to you. You're setting, okay, this much money I have to give. I don't know when I'm going to give it, but I'm going to put it in these pockets and sometime or other. Or put it in a bag or put it in a drawer. Or, do you understand? So that when you find it, you suddenly have, oh yeah, I must perform this action. A So then when you find somebody, you actually look at them like a person and you think of their suffering. And then you don't give money to them so they'll get out of your face. You're actually doing it because it is your joy to practice this. So that's a good kind of practice to start with to develop a compassionate mind. Because once you feel wholesome, you also have a sense of wanting to share that. It's kind of natural, isn't it? Can you remember a time when you had really good news or you did something wonderful in your life? And what did you want to do? Tell somebody. You know what just happened to me? If you're like me, you're on the street corner. Hey, everybody, stop! Have I gotten a deal from you? I had something to tell you. This wonderful thing happened. I found a nickel. Whatever it is. Isn't it true? That impulse is to share. And so having established that sense of wholesomeness, then it just moves out. But you make sure it moves out because often we stop ourselves, don't we, of sharing wholesome. So if you do an exercise like this, it allows you to move the energy. You've set yourself up for something wonderful. Then if you're meditating, what you do for the meditation on compassion is traditionally, and according to this text, what you do is you sit down, establish the sense of loving kindness towards yourself, may I live happily. And then you allow yourself to consider someone. First, generally, someone... This is where newspapers are really excellent. Somebody who's right up against it. Somebody who is really caught in great suffering. And whatever that means to you, you allow that to arise and you hold that person. And you feel your sense of dis-ease at their suffering. And you make the fervent wish, as I am happy, I wish you could be free of suffering. And you practice feeling them being happier. You practice hoping them happiness. You practice hoping them freedom from pain. You practice hoping them freedom from despair. This is called praying in Christian terms. And it works. So you start like that and you break down the barriers of yourself feeling powerless to do anything about someone who's homeless or someone who's a teenager who's run away from home or someone who's caught in jail systems. You know, often when you look at those things, it's just so powerless. You feel so powerless. I mean, what can you do? But you can wish that they were not in the suffering state. But starts the energy moving toward helping. And it certainly opens the compassion of your heart. So that the next time you pass someone on the street who's asking for money, you don't just say, oh, I don't want to know, because you've already opened your mind to them. So if you can't give them anything, you say, I'm sorry, I can't give you anything, but you give them yourself. You treat them like a person. You're not cutting it off. Do you understand that? So that begins to break down the barriers. So after you can do it for somebody who is caught in an obvious state of suffering, then you do the next best person to work with is somebody who has the very bad taste to dislike you. There are occasionally those people in your life, aren't there? Occasionally. Not often, most of us have excellent taste, but sometimes you meet someone who obviously did not have the proper, you know, circumstances to grow good sense and so forth, and actually has reason to distrust you or dislike you or something very strange. But there you are. So that's So then, you take that person, especially if they irritate you a lot. Then you work on, may I be well, may I live happily, may I be happy. You do that for all, you set that. Then you allow yourself to consider for a moment someone whose circumstance is not so happy, and you allow yourself to pray compassion for them. But you go through that fairly quickly because now you're moving there. You allow yourself to visualize that person with bad taste. And you let them arise in all their glory. And then you look at them for a while and you think, what could be the cause of their suffering? Because obviously they must be suffering if they don't have taste. But sometimes it's obvious that maybe they have a bad temper, or maybe they are jealous or something else. So you consider them and you hold them there in your mind just as they are, irritating and all. And you think to yourself, what could be the cause? Now what's different about that than what you usually do when you think of somebody who irritates you?
You don't get caught in suffering yourself, or you don't get caught in irritation or judgment.
You don't get caught in judgment, exactly. What is it? Judgment is when you decide that somebody is a fixed thing, or something is a fixed circumstance. And you don't see the humanness. As soon as you start looking for a cause, you're breaking down your tendency to demonize the person. Sometimes we demonize ourselves. Do you understand what I mean when I say demonize? We make ourselves or another into the demon, don't we? Oh, they're always out to get me. Do you understand? Or some kind of expression like that. So that even if they do something that is just an act of just human, ordinary kindness, we're saying, yeah, I wonder what they want. Because we know. We know what they're really like. And we're going to get the evidence. We just have to watch close enough. They'll prove we're right. You know, maybe we're not so strident as I'm acting it. But we all have that little voice inside. And we all have people with whom we have some difficulty. And we all have a real good reason why they're difficult. And it always has to do with something they did and will probably continue to do, and we're not letting them off that hook. Isn't that true? So there's this distrust and looking for when they're going to do it again. Right? So what you do if you're practicing this action of compassion is you start picking that apart. You start saying, I wonder what caused them to act. That is to say, you're not saying, well, they were born that way, and they're going to die that way, and they've been there from the very no beginning, and they'll be like that at the time of eternity. You're actually saying, this is cause. This comes from conditions and results and circumstances. It's not a permanent state. It's a caused state. I wonder what the causes were. And you start turning that over in your mind. Turning that over and looking at them and starting to care. And you can see, hi, come on in. And you can see the causes to some degree, and then you can see the results. You can start seeing, gee, if they keep doing that, other people who aren't so compassionate as I am gonna beat them up. Or they're gonna die in a really unhappy state, or you know. Nobody's going to trust them. You can begin to understand like what results are going to come to them from those actions, right? You start caring for that. You start caring for that. That's how you start if you're a beginner. And we're talking about loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy. They're called the four boundless states. And I started by asking people to consider what a boundless state might be like. Because if you consider your own states of mind during the day, they all have an object pretty well, don't they? There's a subject and an object. Oh, I'm going to have dinner. I have dinner. Then we've got to get to at and I want to So it's all objects. They're all boundary states. They all have to do with relationship to events or persons or people. Is that true?
Yes.
So, what is a boundless state? What is a state where there is no object? What would that feel like? That's a decent question. And in Buddhism they say loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, boundless space, boundless consciousness, neither perception nor non-perception, and no thingness are the eight boundless states that are possible to be experienced. Well, I'm not going to deal with boundless space, boundless consciousness, neither perception nor non-perception, or no thingness, because I think that's a little more in the realm of people who sit and cross their legs and concentrate for long hours and develop enormous concentration might be interested in learning about. But the states of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity are something that you can work with every day, and they bear very rich rewards. So loving kindness, basically you work with basically the formula, may I live happily, or may I be happy. And then having established that wholesome state, then you say, there is that sense of wanting to share that. Because whenever there is a sense of joy or happiness, it always expands out. I don't think misery loves company nearly as much as happiness loves company. And when you have good news, it's always like, ta-da. And when you're miserable, you tend to close the door. Take my phone off. So with compassion, having established that sense of may I live happily and the confidence of that, then one considers suffering states and begins to develop an ability to wish others to be free of suffering, and maybe even move toward that by giving, you know, gifts, whatever, which is your honor, not the recipient's honor. And then having done that, then you can allow yourself to consider someone who is in a state that is obviously very full of suffering and start to wish or pray that they be free of suffering. Then having done that, then you can move to the next category, breaking down the boundaries again, and you can start to image somebody who, as I was defining it, has the bad taste to dislike you, and hold them up in your consciousness and start to practice compassion with them. At this point, you tend to get into where you fix a judgment on the person, and so it's a little harder to practice compassion than with somebody who's, you know, living on the streets, who is badly damaged because of an accident or something like that. So that you have to work at it a bit more, and the way you work at it is to consider the sense of hostility in which they are caught, either you catch them there or they have caught themselves there, and then start to have a sense of what were the causes that led them to that. That's to say, you're breaking down your stereotyped image of them and beginning to see them as someone subject to the cause and effect in life, the different happenings of life. And you begin to soften your judgment by starting to understand what kind of things they've probably lived through. But you're not negating that they have choices. You're affirming that we are all subject to conditioning. And some of us ignore what different actions will lead us into, and some of us don't. But we're all subject to conditioning. Right? So once you start working that way, then you have the power then to look at all beings, what are called neutral beings, and consider that whoever they may be, they probably are not aware that they're going to get old, or they're going to die, or that illness is possible, or that, you know, if somebody's just fallen in love, then we've got the fact that the sense of falling in love is going to die down, and then they're going to have to work at love, and, you know? All those different things, and you start to feel compassion for the ordinary consciousness. And after you've worked with compassion for the ordinary consciousness, then you work at compassion for someone who you feel very close to, very fond of. It's harder to do, just as it's harder to do loving kindness for somebody who is really hostile, it's harder to practice compassion for somebody who is really close to you. And that's basically because you don't really notice when your brother, sister, aunt, and uncle, father, mother are suffering. You know, you kind of just get along with everybody in your house. You know what I'm saying? It takes a real effort before you turn around and say, well, you're pretty grumpy. You know, you've been grumpy for the last few days, actually. You know, to actually pay attention to someone who, because they're so much a part of you. It's very hard to separate out and see them. You understand that? So they're further down the line. You don't practice compassion with them first. If you're doing the practice of developing compassion. Because it takes some real ability to understanding somebody outside of your assumption of them. And it's easier to see somebody that you have assumed from a distance, like an enemy, than it is somebody that you know really well. Because there's so many assumptions loaded on them. We take each other for granted, therefore we have long-standing relationships. It takes a real lot of work to not take somebody for granted and maintain a relationship. It takes a lot of energy, a lot of effort. So if you're going to practice compassion with somebody who's close to you, then that should happen further down the line. And then the furthest one and the last one, it's done in exactly the opposite order of the loving kindness practice. The one you reverence is last. Now that's the classical way of developing compassion. There is another way of developing compassion that is, for me, easier to work with, and I'll tell it to you now and you can decide what you think would be the best way to work. But for this one, of course, you have to play as we go. So I would like you, whatever state of unhappiness you may be in the present, it's okay, just leave it. I would like you to imagine that you can remember something that happened, say, 4 or 5 years ago. Not a big thing, but something that you were worried about or caused you suffering or caused you pain. Not a big thing. 4 or 5 years ago, and tell me, you just sort of put your hand up when you can remember. So if you haven't got one, just pretend you do. Now let yourself really recall how much that just kind of pecked on you. Let yourself recall the feeling of that at that time. How your mind would turn back to it and go over. Now let yourself move forward in time to when it didn't bother you anymore. Notice the space that's there from where it doesn't bother you. Now go back to when it bothered you again. Feel that sense of irritation and difficulty. Real discomfort of that. Now go forward again to when it doesn't bother you. Feel the space. Now for the last time, go back again to that. Feel that irritation again. While you're focusing your mind on that irritation image, feel, sense that the space is underneath it, like a table is underneath a glass. That irritation is on a basis of space. Then you bring your mind to the present and allow yourself to consider something that's bothering you. Not big bother, little bother. It can be big bother if you want, but it's probably better to start with little ones. Allow yourself to feel the irritation. Imagine yourself in the future when that isn't bothering you. Allow yourself to feel the spaciousness of that. Consider that that spaciousness is here now. Alternate looking at what irritates you and feeling the space below it, or around it, or between it. Realize that spaciousness is always there and the states of suffering are impermanent. Is that interesting? So then at that point, then you would allow yourself to consider some others around you, you know, not ones you know really closely first, just who are unhappy about something. And you imagine them in the future not being unhappy about that, and you go back and forth with that, and you begin to be aware of the spaciousness. You meditate on the spacious quality there in them, under, like it, you know, like this is the spaciousness and this is the suffering. Because the spaciousness is always there. But if you're too caught at being, putting your focus on the suffering, all you see is the suffering. It's very hard to get out of it. So you have to teach yourself to feel somewhere differently. And then you have the position that allows yourself to move out of the suffering. Does that make sense to you? Do you have any questions?
I'm not quite sure that I grasp the concept of the space. I'm not sure what, you know, when you said,
can
imagine
you,
the space below
can,
it.
Can you recall that something that bothered you, say, 3 years ago, that was some small thing that doesn't bother you now?
Mm-hmm.
Can you feel what that was like when it bothered you?
Mm-hmm.
Can you feel what it's when that does not bother you?
Yeah.
Can you watch the mind move from one memory to the other? Can you feel the irritation, bother fading? The
yeah.
space that's left as that fades is always there.
Okay, the space is the non-bother.
The non-bother.
Okay.
It's always there. So beginning to look at that non-bother allows you to have see what it is that suffering arises within. What it is that is the quality of consciousness that is more you than the sense of suffering. Sense of suffering is an event. It's caused. It arises. It has cause. It doesn't come from nowhere. But if you keep going at it, thinking about it, being irritated by it, focusing on it, you don't let go of it enough to allow the spaciousness to come back in. You know what I'm saying?
Okay. That cup of tea really bugs me. I wish somebody would move that cup of tea so I don't have to look at it. Do you see how much that cup of tea bothers me? I can't get over this cup of tea. It's everywhere. Everywhere I look, I just see this cup of tea. What's wrong? But you don't understand, I got a cup of tea right in my nose.
But if you back off a bit, yeah, the cup of tea is still there. But there's a little space from it. Do you understand that? Do you understand that? You need to back off. You need to leave the space. You need to feel the space. I know I simplify things when I do this. It's true. Did you work out anything? I'm talking to the converted here.
I fell off my throne. Oh, life is so hard.
Do you have any other questions? Anyone wants to ask a question about that, or a comment, or a complaint, or answer, or yeah?
Would that be the same as looking at seeing things as the view, in the sense of looking at something as the event just coming and going?
It is similar to the focus on impermanence, but the focus on impermanence is actually on the process, the things that are condition, things that are depend on conditions in order to arise, like a life. for example, or a mustache, anything like that,
is subject to decay. It needs those conditions to be present, and conditions don't last. They depend on other conditions, and conditions are always changing. So whatever is conditioned is impermanent. So, I mean, that's basically looking at impermanence, is to be aware of how everything is moving. Here you're not looking at how everything is moving, you're only looking at the movement in terms of seeing what it is that it's moving through. So your focus isn't on the movement, it's on the medium through which the movement occurs, in which the medium occurs, the movement occurs. You're not looking at the picture, you're looking at the screen. Then the next meditation, sympathetic joy, you're not looking at the picture or the screen, you're looking at the looker. But this meditation, you're looking at the screen, you're looking at the no-thingness, the nothingness, on which the space on which everything arises and falls. First there is space, and then there is form. With the separation, I see you. No separation.
I'm in the teacup.
No separation, you can't see. There's no separateness, there's no perspective, no way to see. No space, no form.
So when your face is in the cup and you need to back away, but you're kind of in that cup, so does that come when you say, just think of something happy for a few minutes? It gives you that?
Sure. Anything that develops that perspective. One of the most powerfully difficult things about depression is that when the memory works basically by recalling similar emotional states first. So if you're really happy, you can remember all kinds of happy things. And you know why everybody should be happy, and you're probably obnoxious as all get up, going out and telling everybody why they should be happy. And some people are glad to hear that, and others are not, you know. And when you're depressed, there's no point. And when you think back, all you can think is depressed. So it seems like nothing has ever changed. It's always the same. And one of the things that really is terrible about depression is that everything always seems the same. It's as if there is no change. If there's a small change, it's negated right away because it's probably not going to last. You understand? So there is this powerful pull into sameness. So any kind of acknowledgement you can get of the smallest differentiation begins to give you a way out of depression. Any perspective breaks the fixed view. Some people use that as an excuse for teaching in rather extreme methods. I'm not so sure I always agree, and do remind me of that next time I yell at you.
Okay. And I'll yell why I do it anyway. No.
Maybe. Is that reasonable?
Yeah.
I remember when the classical way of doing the meditation is, as I said, starting with somebody for whom you have greater pain. And I remember that happening when I was in hospital when I was 16, and I was wheeled out in the hall once because my roommate was, you know, having some medical procedure that, and funny, after you spend day and night with somebody, so there's nothing intimate about them, that about each other, that you don't know. Then when they decide to do some test, they wheel you out of the hall. I always wondered why they do that, but anyway. So I was wheeled out in the hall, and I was put, my bed was put right outside the door of a young man, he was 19, I was 16, who had just been admitted to hospital about 3 weeks before. I'd been there for 2 months before. So far, and he had just been in
for 3 weeks or so. And he had had massive burns over his body. You know, I was in a hospital, not much is happening, but gossip is big. Mm-hmm. Gossip and eavesdropping are two of the most skilled things in wards where you don't move around much. You know, that's really where it's at. Just always outside his door. And I had felt such, I didn't know how anybody could go through the pain of having so much of your body burned. Because in those days they didn't give a lot of painkillers with burns. There's something about infections, or I'm not sure what it was. But. And he always seemed very cheerful when I was eavesdropping. I was always amazed, you know. I thought, wow, he's so brave. And it really helped me a lot, actually, to see his bravery. So they wheeled me out, and they got me outside his door. Well, he's got a visitor, so I'm eavesdropping. And he and his visitor are talking, and his visitor is saying something. It must be really hard, you know, to be in such pain. I'm so sorry this happened to you. And it's, I can't imagine being in pain and surrounded by people in pain. That would just make it worse, as I was saying. And this man that was in the hospital said, well, no, he said, actually, you know, I think if I wasn't here, it'd be a lot worse. Because he said, you know, I could start to feel sorry for myself, but, you know, there are people in here, there's this one person in here, you know, she's never going to walk. She's 16 years old, and she was hit by a truck. And I realized he was talking about me. And there I am, having this sense of the courage he has, and okay, I can go a little further because of him. And there he is, having a sense of the courage of, oh yeah, you can go a little further because of me. It was like a little light bulb went on. And I understood that, you know, really, if you really pay attention to others, it makes your own suffering less. So that's how the classical meditation and compassion starts, by working with someone who is in great duress, and then move to someone who is not in duress so much. And then you develop that ability to feel compassion for all states. That is to say, you have developed the ability to see the spacious quality of consciousness in which cause and effect are dancing. You don't mistake the cause and effect for the spacious quality. And you don't mistake the spacious quality for the cause and effect. You can separate out yourself from the state of suffering. Whatever yourself is, it is not conditioned. It is not, there is some aspect, I should say this way, there is some aspect of yourself that is unconditioned, unborn, uncreated. And that's the part you want to go to. Don't want to have your focus on the suffering. You don't want to ignore the suffering, because that's just more suffering. Go right through it. Find what's on the other side.
So what you're saying is that when suffering does occur, just to sort of be in the suffering and recognize it for what it is, but don't play with it or don't engage it or...
Totally allow the feeling of it and keep a context. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the context that is suggested in Buddhism is the context of the sense of wholesomeness about yourself. Sometimes it's very hard to feel wholesome about yourself from thought. But the physical body always has a sense of wholesomeness. Even if you have cancer, if you're dying of cancer, that part of you that is still alive feels quite wholesomely alive. So focus on the physical sense of feeling and then open yourself to feeling the suffering within the framework of that being present to yourself, the physical self. Then those emotions can move through. And then you'll see them as impermanent, and then you see the space underneath them. See the mind in which those events are arising, or the space, spacious quality of mind in which those are. You don't see the mind until the next meditation, until sympathetic joy. In this meditation, you see the spacious quality. You're seeing a quality of consciousness. First meditation, you see a function of consciousness to make everything beautiful. As far as I'm concerned, we're all poets, because I love poetry. But humans image, create, make. And to fall in love with what is making is loving kindness. And the second one is to see the quality of consciousness, the spaciousness. The third meditation of the boundless ones is to look at consciousness itself, sympathetic joy. But we'll talk about that tomorrow. Tomorrow is that one. Now there is another way to practice compassion, which my beloved teacher Namjo Rinpoche summed up really beautifully in one little throwaway line in the one class I went to. He said, light in, light out. No, life in, light out.
I'm sorry, life in,
light out. Life in, light out. Take life in, send light out. Allow the states to arise and be present in spaciousness. And that is basically what in the Tibetan tradition they call Tonglen, the Tonglen practice. Which when you begin doing Tonglen, you imagine that a small figure of the guru or a small figure of a being who you have great love for, maybe Christ, it doesn't matter, maybe Muhammad, it doesn't matter, maybe your mother, maybe your father, maybe Santa Claus, who cares? Some being that evokes that sense of care for you, whoever it may be, maybe you make it up. Maybe one of your children, who knows? You imagine that figure, we call it Guru Rinpoche, because that figure is, Guru Rinpoche is that principle of the caring overseer, in a way, caring, the compassionate consciousness of knowledge. That is a universal principle. Where there is consciousness, there is a quality of it that is compassionately known. So you imagine a figure that represents that in your heart. And you hold that figure in your heart and you pray that you be able to hear that figure no matter where you go. And then you consider, you say, also not only myself, but others are suffering from ignorance. And I have this as my guide, as my joy. But others are caught in many different states. For the sake of all beings, may I take the suffering that they're subject to. And you breathe it in, and you imagine it becomes like, you imagine that the figure of the guru is in your heart, and in front of him you put this little seed of all your self-cherishing, all the ways that you cling. You make it this compacted little black, little tight little weighing 50 billion thousand hundred million quadruple tons. Little black seed, you put it right in front of the guru figure. And that represents all your ego clinging and fears and graspings and pains and how you cling to them or afraid of them and get caught by them, compact them in this little black sea. And then as you breathe in, the suffering of all beings, as it comes into your nostril, it becomes like an arrow and it smashes that seed into smithereens of rainbow dust. And as you breathe out, rainbow consciousness and light goes to all beings. It's called Tonglen, and you do 3 rounds of breathing like that when you do that practice. Usually it's a full moon. So the puja called the Guru Puja, and that's usually part it's called taking and receiving. Sometimes you see in a Tibetan text it talks about taking and receiving, and that's it's talking about that. And you can see that it's true that taking in the suffering of others, like I was in the hospital, reduces this clinging of self to suffering, clinging to self. If you're caught by wishing you did not have to hear anybody else's complaint, it's not that you can't take in their suffering, it's that you can't let go of your sense that you should be other than you are. You can't just allow yourself to feel your imperfection, because when you hear somebody else's suffering, you're aware of how you can't do anything. Aren't you? So you have to open your heart to feel that suffering and then share the space of suffering. And then it moves. So you have to feel wholesome enough about yourself to be a total medium. And then you can be present. It is not you or I who fix anything. There is that in every human being that is the wisest of the wise, the most loving of all lovers, that always knows the way through. And if for a moment you con me into thinking I'm helping you, I hope we both come to our senses quickly. If for even a moment I con you into thinking that you're helping me, I hope we move out of that and recognize that it is the bodhicitta speaking, the awakened consciousness, the possibility of wisdom, speaking to the possibility of wisdom that really does the healing. There is the guru in each of our hearts. There is that which knows in each of us. There is something in you that knows all the pathways through. And it's that that does the healing. So if I am aware of what I cannot do, it's time I felt hopeless so that I return to that which does. Does that make sense to you as well? Do you have a question for me?
Is that which knows, or the bodhicitta, the awakening consciousness, is it more reinforced through the power of prayer and meditation also, to give that latitude, the awakening, to sort of say that I don't know what's going on, I am powerless, and I'm just going to throw this in your lap, and you show me, mm-hmm. by putting faith in that power of prayer and meditation?
Yeah, you can do that. That's called taking refuge.
Mm.
Yeah. I absolutely do that. It's called taking refuge. There are a lot of different ways to take refuge, but that's the basic seed for it all. Because sometimes if you're cause and effect dancing in space, you get too caught up in cause and effect and forget about the space, mm-hmm. so you need to call to the space for more awareness. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if your space is too caught up to be aware of cause and effect, you need to call for the cause and effect to balance you and engage your space up. We tend often to think that, you know, we should be spaced. That's not what's happening. And the universe hasn't made any mistakes yet. Yet.
Yeah, we know. I don't want to know.
So now what? What do you want to talk about now? Do you have any more questions? If you don't, I'm surprised at you. Have any of you done Chen Wei's meditation yet? Any of you? Mm-hmm. Do you have any questions about how this fits in with Chen Wei's? It does fit in with Cheng Weizi, because if you notice that the Cheng Weizi meditation is basically working with space and light, right? Light is sound. And once you distinguish the spacious quality that is present, you can start being aware of different types of space. You know, there's a vast difference in the quality of space that you feel in the closet and the space that you feel outside at night. Isn't there? A whole different felt sense. So in the Cheng Weizi meditation, it starts with taking refuge. And you take refuge how? By realizing that compassion is not separate from the activity that stirs the pit, the depth of the blind wandering state. Compassion is not separate from all of the activity that is occurring in it. That all of the activity is compassion.
I don't understand that.
So, if we are going to pay attention to compassion, what do we need? What do we use to do that? And as you begin to pay attention to suffering, what do you become aware of? The non-fixedness of it, the spacious quality. So suffering becomes spacious as you go into it. You try to get away from it, it gets hard, it gets unmovable. You try to figure it out, it gets constant, it gets demonic. You go into it with some sense of kindness, with some sense of willingness, some sense of even love. It becomes more spacious, it becomes little moments of cause and effect, not one solid object. Try to figure it out, you try to understand why it's happening to you, why it's happening to them, why it's happening. Any way that you try to handle it gets bigger, more powerful in your face, like that teacup. pay attention to it, look at it in detail, which you do in that chair, is you look at the six rows. Mm-hmm. It loosens, starts to loosen. You start to have a different felt sense of how to move. It starts to be a difference between you and the suffering, between the other being and the suffering. The suffering is caused by either willful or unwillful ignorance. The willful is probably easier for you to understand in certain ways, you know.
Well, you deserve it.
Kind of stuff. But I think they're both quite understandable. As a group of humans, we have certain ways of acting that create states of suffering that all humans will be subject to. The whole question of innocence, why hasn't anybody brought up the whole question of innocence? It's always one that I hear. Oh, wow. I'll answer it anyway. There is no innocent. Nobody's innocent. Unknowing? Yeah. Unskilled? Yeah. Innocent? I don't understand. If innocent means not consciously working with, then I understand it. But if it means white as snow and capable of stupidity, I don't understand. I've never met anyone who is innocent. And I've met quite a few newborn humans. And puppies and cats and birds even and fish. You dear. I never met anyone who's innocent. Unskilled, yes. Especially unskilled in using a physical body yet, you know. I don't know how many of you have spent any time with a newborn? Any of you? How many of you have spent any time with more than one newborn? And were they different? A whole different feeling. No. Every human being does not come out, you know, washed with sanctity and then is marred by light. It's an agenda that's born. Just working out its way to act, you know. When Tchaikovsky was 4, he said to his mother, "How do you turn off the music?"
So he was saying no one was playing any music, he was hearing it inside his head?
Yeah.
That's an interesting question.
Symphonies. Mm-hmm. He wrote them later, after he learned how to play music. So is that like innocent? No agenda? Where's my music? I'm trying. Hey, Igor, how'd you do that? Well, that was Stravinsky. Petro. Dave. Yeah? Hmm? Sorry? Who has a question here?
I just, the definition of innocence as opposed to guilt, I mean, are you connected?
Well,
guilt
is...
We're not talking about it in terms of innocence and guilt. We're talking about it in terms of innocence as in...
As in innocent.
So not guilty.
But we're all guilty.
Well, not right. I mean...
Yeah. But some people are caught in a sort of a continuously that conceit of going back and seeing how bad they are. You understand?
Oh, yeah.
Going back over and over again, seeing how bad they are. That's conceit.
Yeah.
That's conceit. That's like yourself becoming bigger than the universe. from a Buddhist point of view, that's conceit. That's not remorse or guilt. That's like a lack of perspective. I mean, if you were that bad, United Nations would have said something by now. They would have had a special meeting. Gotta go to Edmonton. We need peace troops. We can't send Canadian this time. How about some Bosnian peace troops? We got some deals to do there. It's a different way of looking, but you can see how true it is, how much energy conceit takes, how much of your energy it takes to continuously, you know, berate yourself, and how much energy of your friends it takes, too. I mean, they can really love you, but they just get tired. They don't love you any less, they just need a break. We talked about that a bit last night, about the three conceits. There are three conceits. If you're a Buddhist, you don't get one, you get three. I recommend you sign up, actually. There are several things about Buddhism that are quite good. You get three conceits. zest, exuberance is particularly wonderful. You get, if you have zest, exuberance, joie de vivre, and all that happening in your body, you feel, you get diarrhea, you get nausea, you feel as if ants are crawling on your body, or else you feel as if lice are crawling. Your body jerks and dash around, you shiver, you shake. It's quite, I mean, we'll have a paper upstairs if you want to sign up. I mean, it's very cheap. It's a cheap religion. Hear that? The Buddhist truths, three conceits and lots of zest that you would wonder what was happening to. See, I bet you thought that shaking was weird, didn't you? But it's not. I mean, oh, yeah, another Buddhist. Oh, yeah.
I didn't even have to sign up.
No. You came fully launched. Are you glad to know that zest and exuberance is not nice to know?
I don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's well documented. I mean, 2,500 years ago it was written about. And it's well documented. In meditation, it's a well understood phenomenon. It's not unusual at all.
So zest and exuberance is conceit?
No, zest, exuberance. I'm saying Buddhism has these wonderful offers. Mm-hmm. You should really... It's better than the Publishers Clearinghouse, the offers we have. We don't have Ed McMahon, but we have other things. Us Buddhists. I'm just rambling ridiculously now. Do you have any more questions you want to ask about, perhaps?
Talk about three conceits. When you come across that, either with yourself or... What is the antidote to that, just recognizing that all of that you're getting to, let's say, less
just
than...
Just self.
Yeah, like poor self. Me or woo me, if you get the whole wooing of self-pity, which would be, I guess, a conceit. How does one deal with that? Just spaciousness and recognition of it, or just why?
First of all, you do recognize it. That's the first thing to do. And then the next thing you do, and the easiest way to work with it, which is immediately possible, is saying, well, what is it that makes this an I? Is it my glasses? If I take my glasses off, is it still an I? Doesn't see as well, but it's still... What about if I had a heart transplant, if I had, you know, if I lost my arm? What if I had no bones with this? You understand? You start to analyze that way. That's the most classical way of beginning to break that down. Because it's basically an idea. The self is basically an idea. There is something called ego. or ego structure, there is a function of mind that separates out in time and then dissolves back again. You understand? There is a function of mind that is an ego,
mm-hmm.
that separates out, takes a position, names,
mm-hmm.
or it's called out, and then dissolves out of that awareness back to the totality mind, and then separates out all the time. It's beating in and out all the time. The mistake comes when you keep holding one view and you keep making that separate out and have the same view over and over and over and over again. Consciousness usually does that if there's trauma. If there has been some shock or some difficulty, this lifetime, previous lifetime, it doesn't matter when, sometimes it's for a previous lifetime, it can be very strong. That keeps circling the mind back to that something to audience. There are other ways also of proceeding with it. One of them is to consider they'll come more with the equanimity when we talk about equanimity, which is two classes from that. But when you consider back in time when I was this age, you know, what were my tastes and concerns and when I was that age, and then in the future, you know, when I'm not in this body, when I die.
And why is the other conceit equal to considered defeated? Still because
it's all self-referencing. Self is more important than the entire world, the universe,
okay.
and manifest creation.
Okay.
Repeat that, please.
There are three conceits. One is, I'm better than everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, poor me, I am really worse than you. Mm-hmm. So sorry to be here, blah, here. And, well, we're equal, you know. You had that experience. Oh, I remember I did something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're talking to somebody and you can feel them, at a certain point their mind just shuts off. Because they're just waiting for you to stop because they're going to tell you a story of when they did something similar.
Oh, yeah.
mm-hmm.
I am equal. It's that insecurity. The fear. You know, so they're caught in the conceit. Conceit is very painful. Because it limits your joy.
Or it'll be better. Your stories will get better. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes. Mm-hmm. If they're doing bigger, then it's I'm superior. But, you know, if you have an experience and you're telling somebody that and they say, yeah, you know, my cousin had that too. I remember my cousin just said, yeah. I get migraine headache. I have often gotten a lot of migraines in Calgary, when I live in Calgary. I used to get them all the time when I was a kid. And my mother had forgotten that I used to have migraines. And she phoned me once. I had a particularly bad one. I was actually in bed. Is very bad. And she said, what's wrong, dear? And I said, oh, I've got quite a migraine. She said, oh, Ruth gets them all the time. Yeah. Now, she doesn't know what to say, so she feels insecure. Oh my God, what can she can't help me. So she just immediately switches to another story. Sort of block, you know, oh, I know that.
Yeah.
That is where compassion could come in, but in this case, I am equal comes in. A lot of people find that very irritating, and a lot of people make that their whole way of conversation, where somebody tells a story, then everybody at the table tells the same story, but from
different
their aunt, uncle, themselves, their, you know, something they saw on Oprah. It almost doesn't matter where you get it. You just go fishing. Oh yeah, match.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the three conceits, where whenever there is an experience, it has to immediately already be named according to my experience. It has to always relate to what I already know. So the universe is continually forced into the thimble of your own being.
Which projected out. You talked about the conceit limits the joy. The conceit limits joy, you're saying?
Conceit really limits joy.
And because it
because it's not free, there's no joy, there's no freedom, there's no newness. There's no being present, everything is a reflection back. Checking on myself, how do I look? It's like if you're at a dance and you're 14 years old and you're terribly embarrassed and you're standing at the wall and you're wondering if you look cool. All the time.
All the time.
That's conceit. Is that joy?
No.
Does that pretty well sum it up?
And there's 10 other guys against the wall doing the
same thing.
Somebody's
a plague.
It's a virus. Yeah.
One, it sort of dies down and immediately.
Guys, time to go home.
Let me out of here. Oh, be cool.
Yeah.
Oh, can I run now?
Yeah. As well.
Yeah. Don't we all? Yeah. We're all laughing.
Makes a clear soul.
But what you were saying too, like when someone's sharing an experience, it just seems like I have to match it with something else. I'm not really allowing myself to enjoy sympathetic joy for the other person's experience, just to be happy for them for their experience. Is that where we're coming in with that too?
Or seeing them as a live person.
Yeah, and being happy for them.
You immediately pull it back down to, oh yeah, I've already done that.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's safe. Oh yeah, I'm okay. Yeah. Oh, I can make that as big as me. Oh yeah. Oh, it doesn't have to be big. It doesn't have to overwhelm me. Oh yeah, I can. So you wouldn't practice compassion for somebody like that until you've done the other two first, the one that's obviously suffering and the hostile. Because it's too likely to bring up your irritation. Because you can feel like you're closed out when somebody does that, because they are closing you up. But they're closing everything out.
Mm-hmm.
There ain't nothing personal in it. It's not personal. It's suffering.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lack of joy. You could like light sparklers while they're talking, or blow bubbles, or do something that might, for a moment, release the childish ability of them to say, wow. But I wouldn't suggest that unless you're pretty fast on your mind.
Silence be like just not joining in and getting in and playing that game, be good attitude to that.
Well, if you think of it as a game, then if I were you, I would recommend that it really doesn't matter what you do, because you're still going to suffer, because you're not out of suffering. It's not a game; it's blindness. It is pain.
But what I'm saying is, that if you're doing the whole conceit, like. If you're doing that same thing, I mean, I see myself match for match.
Then while you're doing it, say to yourself, gee, I could die any minute. They could die. This might be the very last breath they take. It cuts through that. If you catch yourself doing that, just consider you're just about to die. Lightning is going to strike. And it just brings energy into it. Understand? Because you're always doing that to make yourself safe for the next moment, you see? So if you just take the next moment out of it, you're not going to do that.
So much of what we do is for what we're going to be. So just drop that and be where you are. About half of your suffering will just dissolve. It's not life that is so painful, it's a resistance to life. Trying to control it, trying to hold it, trying to figure it out before you taste it. I have a friend who, if you say to her, okay, I'll meet you 3 blocks away, she'll say, well, exactly how many pieces of gravel are on the road between you? Of course, I never yell at her anymore. I just do snide little comments. She hardly sees the blood. She probably prefers me. But the trust of just being there, not fixing anything, would do a lot more for your confidence. Because what are you going to protect yourself from? Old age? I got a real shock the other day. I was visiting my mother in her senior's apartment there, and I was talking to the manager, and I said, gee, you got 3 empty suites. That's the first time I've seen that. He says, I've been here 12 years. I've never had so many empty suites. I said, you know, that's really amazing. He said, yes, we've even dropped the age where people can move in here. I said, oh, yeah, what is it now? He said, 60. I went, oh, that's 3 years away. Should I pick out my apartment? Albany. Sickness, death, they're all there. Snapping your trees. So it's nice to maybe consider it every once in a while. This could be my last breath. This might be your last breath. The intensity of joy certainly builds when you do that. Which is where conceit comes in, is a lack of joy. You want to get rid of the conceits, practice joy. Don't try to figure out the position. Or even the imposition. How are we doing? Have I harangued you? Oh yes, it's 9:00. I've harangued you enough. It's a wonderful thing for me to be able to share this teaching on the 4 Brahma Viharas. I think they're such beautiful teaching and so useful in our life. Loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. And so possible, you know, that one about putting a little bit of change ahead of time. Clothes. It's a very nice thing to do. Maybe you'll be the one you give it to. You might need 25 cents at the grocery store. Yeah. You know? Oh, good, it's me.
Here, me, take this. Oh, thank you. You're welcome. Thank you, I'm welcome.
They have those great, well, people now, they sell it on paper. I don't know if they have any comment, but yeah.
Yeah.
Which is nice because normally they'd be big, some of these individuals would be just, you know, panhandling, but now they stand and there's mm-hmm. these, when you buy the paper, there's an opportunity for exchange. Like, hello, how are you, thank you, you know.
Mm-hmm. It is, it's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think I've seen that paper in Montreal, in Vancouver, Victoria, in Calgary, in Edmonton.
Is it called?
Voice? What?
They just changed
the name. Yeah. Is that what they just changed it to? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. One guy I bought paper from just when they were going to change the name. We got into this conversation for half an hour about the fact they were going to change the name, and he didn't even be sure. Really wanted me to write to the editors. Mm-hmm.
was a really interesting conversation. Yeah, it is a good thing. So, all right, for now, don't forget your change. Feel this beautiful gold energy in your heart. Just makes the whole center of your body feel quite warm and gooey. Like a caramel candy with soft caramel inside, right there in the middle of your body. And that light, this gold light from that little caramel there just spreads out through your whole body, right through your trunk. Up through your head, down your arms, and your legs. Pours out your pores in all directions above, both you. Front, behind, the right, the left, the four quarters. Moves through this room, through the earth, through space, through all Edmonton, through the whole world. Wherever there is suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, and mind, the light just temporarily washes away. And we take whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together to share it with all beings so there is no suffering. Whatever.